If you would like to pick the film that John and Michael talk about on the next Forgotten Horrors podcast, just take a picture of yourself holding a Forgotten Horrors book and put it up on Facebook on our Forgotten Horrors podcast group or on Instagram, hashtag Forgotten Horrors podcast. I will look you up, ask you what your choice is, and chances are it'll be a million times better than what I picked last week. Thank you and enjoy the show.
Who taught him you never made it?
I'm saving myself for when I get married.
You're saving yourself for when you meet a rich daddy.
You don't talk to me like that, Duke.
Roger, I'm ready for bed.
Quiet noises.
Where did you first meet your husband?
Oh, in school. We were kids together. We went to some dances and fell in love.
It's like a bath.
Come on in.
Oh, no, thanks. I get my hair wet.
I guess it's too nice.
How do you know?
How long does it take? You want me to go down there and drag her up here by the hair? You want me to hold her while she screams?
Take it for yourself, aren't you?
Nobody's gonna take nothing.
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors podcast, take one. Do the appropriate music. No. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
Thank you very much, Michael H. Price. It's my privilege to introduce you, the man behind the Forgotten Horrors franchise and the Comics from the Gone World franchise.
Oh, you are a
franchise holder, Michael.
Well, and I still haven't sold any chicken yet.
One of the things that happened with Colonel Sanders was he ended up making a Herschel Gordon Lewis picture. As I recall it, he was in the picture, and it just escaped my mind what the name of the picture was. It was Gorgor Girls?
I think it was. I'd have to go back and look.
It's the one with Henny Youngman in it, I believe.
That's the Gorgor Girls.
And as I understand it, he got a part in the picture because they ate nothing but Kentucky Fried Chicken on the set for the whole time. Craft Services was basically KFC the whole time they were shooting the picture.
That explains a lot about what's wrong with that film, I should think.
It certainly does. It does indeed.
Oh, Colonel Sanders was quick to cavalierly dismiss the competition, but boy, I tell you what, I've never come away from a KFC meal that didn't leave me groaning.
Well, you know, in 1969, I went to the Dallas Pop Festival, which was the first major pop festival after Woodstock, if I'm not mistaken.
It and Lubbock were fairly close together.
Okay,
yeah.
This was at the Speedway, I remember. We drove down from Stillwater. I was going to school there. And yeah. I remember that Minnie Pearl's Fried Chicken donated I don't know how many thousands of meals for the people that were attending the rock festival there.
Well, who'd have suspected?
Yeah, and I never forgot that. And I like Minnie Pearl's chicken too, but
she had a good chicken brand. You know, I read the Colonel's autobiography once, and he was fond of repeating the phrase, all that other fried chicken just leaves a dough ball in the pit of your stomach. It's like, look who's talking.
That's right. That's right. When you're pointing, there's three fingers pointing back at you, right? Boy, that's interesting. I don't know how we got off on
finger pointing. Good,
but yeah, finger licking good.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, absolutely. So, you really picked one this time, and this was your pick. You know, I don't think it's any secret that we generally tend to alternate our picks. You picked
right.
Private Property, which, as nearly as I can tell, and you can tell me whether this is true or not, as Joey and I were watching it, I noticed that for 1960, it was very daring in its subject matter, its dialogue, and I suspect that it, and this is borne out with what little research I've been able to do, that it showed mostly in art houses and couldn't get an MPAA seal. Is that am I right about that?
The purity seal was denied outright. The distribution never went to any company that could get it into the downtown theaters. It played mostly drive-ins and what we now call grindhouses.
Was it states' rights distribution, basically, then?
It was basically states' rights distribution, and I'm always amused to look at the name of the production company, which is Daystar Productions.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wonder today how the oh-so-holier-than-thou Daystar TV network would take that.
Well, you know, when the Oral Roberts University is here in Tulsa, of course, and when they started their TV station, it was at a little UHF. This is the days, really pre-cable days, or just beginning of cable days. They had a little UHF, low-power UHF station, and they bought a movie package, which had, you know, the cheapest movie package possible. I'm sure mostly public domain. It had those John Wayne Lone Star Westerns and all of those sorts of things. But what whoever bought it didn't realize was that they're very old pictures. But before 1934, of course, before Breen came along, the Hayes office didn't really have many teeth, and there was a lot of stuff that was going on. I remember they played, for instance, I Cover the Waterfront, which was very cavalier in its attitude toward the two leads, Ben Lyon and Claudette Colbert, and there was no doubt that they were sleeping together.
Nude swimming scene
in it, and something like the Costello murder case, where they swear and use Jesus' name in vain and everything. And I guess they figured if the films were old enough, then they had nothing to worry about. And they didn't realize.
People to say who still long for the innocent days of old Hollywood.
That would be the Fatty Arbuckle and William Desmond Taylor days, I guess.
Yeah.
So what we're talking about is a film called Private Property from 1960. Really nicely done. Corey Allen, who everybody knows, of course, from Rebel Without a Cause, the guy that dies in the chicken race, and Warren Oates in a very, very early appearance. And
a prototype, I think, for Billy Bob Thornton, yeah.
Probably so. And a lovely woman named Kate Manx, who was married to the producer, right? The producer-director.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And right. So, essentially, you read thumbnail descriptions of this picture on whatever in the paper or in a book or, you know, something that provides just a line or two about what it's supposed to be about. And you get the idea it's some sort of home invasion thing with two hoods. But this is far more nuanced and detailed than that. And also, it's very artfully done. I think it aspires to some artistic sensibilities are there, I think.
Well, yeah, Leslie Stevens, the producer and director, had intellectual property credentials dating back to the 50s on Broadway with a play called The Marriage Go-Round.
Yes.
And of course, by the time he made Private Property, he had already done the screenplay for The Left-Handed Gun.
Yes, right.
The rather over-intellectualized tale of Billy the Kid.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. But a pretty good film on its, you know, if you can get, it's cerebral, but pretty nice.
Well, if you can get past the fact that the photo that Gore Vidal took the title from was a tintype. It was a mirror image. He wasn't left-handed.
Right, right.
Go figure that.
Well,
anyway.
Beyond that, though, right?
I'm striving to pick. Private Property is an unabashed it's a study of three deteriorating minds.
Yes, it's basically a three character play. Yeah,
yeah.
And although we do see Jerome, the always welcome Jerome Cowan at the very beginning.
And Grouch.
Yeah, and you know, that kind of provides a little bit of a starting point for us. But what we've got here is just a couple of drifters. They call women a woman a twitch, which I think is very interesting. And they have this kind of stylized slang. There's all this voyeurism. There's a little bit, to me, there's a little bit of a gay subtext in it. There's all kinds of different things in it. And it's just, you know, Kate Manx is just great in it. And of course, she ended up, did a couple more things and a couple of TV shows. And as you say, was married to Leslie Stevens. And then after they divorced, as I understand it, she took her own life with a sleeping pill overdose.
Yes.
And it's a shame because she is just really striking in this picture.
She's a more mature version in this picture of the role that Anne Margaret played during the same period in Kitten
with
the
Whip. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree. Do you get a Psycho vibe from this as well?
Oh, definitely.
Black and white, kind of psychosexual overtone kind of thing going on there.
That is kind of a foregone conclusion with Leslie Stevens, in as much as he was dealing in these kind of perverse psychological nuances about the same time, and probably, maybe, he wasn't as prolific as Robert Bloch, but he may have been a little bit more, less pop psychology.
Now, do you know much about Marriage Go Round? Was that an example of what you're talking about?
It's basically a satire.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe a more lighthearted twist on what you got with Toys in the Attic.
Gotcha. Okay.
That sort of thing. The Left-Handed Gun is one of the darkest westerns ever made, and yes, I admire it greatly. I take issue with some of the presumptions made about Billy the Kid, but
right.
Hey, it's their movie, and they're welcome to, you know. but the dynamic not only between Duke and Boots, the two drifters, but among the three, and this unhappily married woman they're
mm-hmm.
pursuing,
mm-hmm.
Boy, howdy! I mean, this is like some highfalutin critic once wrote about a different film that the characters create a triangle of inexorably shifting dimensions.
That's a very good way to put it. And I even looked at the juxtaposition between the two couples and, you know, how because they both function as couples, both function as dysfunctional couples, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And the closest to stereotype that we have here, I think, is Kate Manx's husband, who is one of those man in the gray flannel suit types, very 50s kind of go-go, make the sales, that whole kind of archetype that we've come to associate.
Yeah, the kind of character that you expect Robert Young would be like from Father's Knows Best would be like if you got to see him outside the home.
Right, exactly. So try to see him driving a deal home or something. That's right. Yeah.
Right.
But it's just full, I mean, it is full of sexual innuendo and metaphor. I mean, you got those olive trees, that whole thing about that. You've got all these different things that to me are the mark of a real intelligence at work.
It's a Well, it's hardly surprising to realize that Leslie Stevens went on to do one of the brainier science fiction programs of that period's television, network television, seeing The Outer Limits.
Right.
And what else? Well, he was extremely prolific for a long stretch. Kind of disappeared during the 80s, 90s. I think one of his last produced screenplays was that Blue Lagoon sequel, which, like, what?
Oh,
but
really?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't connect him with that. Okay.
Right, and he wrote the scenario, not to say the finished shooting script, for the 1984 version of Sheena, Queen of the Jungle.
Oh, my.
But, you know, everybody's got to hit that downhill run sooner or later.
Sure, it's got that. He was on the other side of that bell-shaped curve that we're always talking about.
Yes.
Not much you can do there.
But when he was in his prime of productivity, as well, I think probably the peak would be The Name of the Game.
Mm-hmm.
The network television series of the late 60s,
which was a breakthrough in terms of the made for TV movie, right? There was a 90-minute made for TV movie.
Right.
When there weren't many of those around.
And a coherent series that also featured interchangeable rotating cast.
Yeah, Franciosa was the guy that initially started that, right? Tony Franciosa was the initial protagonist in that, yeah.
Right, and then Gene Barry and
right.
so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Stevens wrote some excellent teleplays for McLeod.
I see. I did not know that, yeah.
And then, you know, he didn't just crater all at once. It was a gradual decline. I think I must have rushed in on the 1979 Buck Rogers film, expecting great things from the creator of The Outer Limits, and whoo boy was I ever disappointed.
So he was the producer of that as well.
I believe he only wrote the screenplay.
Wrote the screenplay
I haven't looked up the particulars there, but. I think he produced some in the 70s,
mm-hmm.
but he was pretty much out of the game by the 1980s, except as a screenwriter.
Well, what do you know about what happened then to Private Property?
It didn't sell.
Yeah.
There was a special circle in hell reserved for films that didn't sell.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously the distributor did not manufacture many prints.
Right.
And those that were manufactured, they played their little limited run. There were no... I haven't gone back to look to see if Variety or any of the trade papers reviewed it,
mm-hmm.
but knowing the trade papers, as opposed to the mainstream newspaper critics, the trade papers would not review a film on aesthetic values so much as they would review a film on whether this will sell tickets for your theater.
Sure, box office potential, wherever you are.
Yeah, it was the theater operators who read Variety and Hollywood Reporter and what have you.
Weren't that interested in art and more interested in commerce?
They were, yes, exactly. And a film like this is the antithesis of a ticket seller.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's lurid, yes.
Mm-hmm.
It has titillating moments. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't wallow in it.
Right, right.
You come out of this film after, what, an hour and a half of immersion in the sordid lives of three, four very unlikable characters.
Yes.
And the film dares you to feel any sympathy. I mean, I came away admiring the more assertive character Duke than the rather dim-witted and confused Warren Oates character Boots.
Mm-hmm. But boy, Duke had his own problems, didn't he?
Oh yeah,
maybe even more than Boots.
not admirable, but mm-hmm. certainly an assertive character.
Boy, he did go into a Brando attack there at the end, though, didn't he?
Oh, yeah.
My.
I love it when they do that. That was probably the best imitation Brando I've ever seen, barring Larry Fine in that Three Stooges short.
Which one was that?
Cuckoo on a Choo-Choo with Larry doing Brando in Streetcar. And it's wonderful.
Oh, man. Well, this was definitely an homage, I guess, to Brando when he just goes completely off his trolley there at the end.
Well, you know, Brando was like the Elvis Presley of acting. He inspired right. a lot of imitators.
And these guys were, I guess, method? Both of them were method guys?
I certainly know that about Warren Oates.
Mm-hmm.
Corey Allen, yes, I believe probably so.
Who then went on and had a pretty nice career as a director.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
you know, so he stayed around in the business and actually had some longevity in the business, as Warren Oates did.
And, of course, Warren Oates has had a career that just, you know, it I think he was still acting after he had died because of the prolific nature of his work. I mean, mm-hmm. he had posthumous appearances as late as the middle 80s.
Mm-hmm.
What could he not play?
Right.
The Hired Hand with Peter Fonda, mm-hmm. the scene-stealing, scene-snatching appearance in The Heat of the Night.
Mm-hmm. Tulane Blacktop's one of my favorites.
Tulane Blacktop. Mm-hmm. I got to meet him when they were shooting Tulane Blacktop.
See, they shot in Oklahoma and Tulsa, right? Because they shot
yeah.
a lot of that in Oklahoma.
And around Tucumcari as well.
Right. Oh, so is that where you saw him, was Tucumcari?
Yeah, I met him in Tucumcari. Spent some time with him and James Taylor. And, of course, he remained associated with Stevens on at least one episode of The Outer Limits.
Yes.
The one I'm looking for is Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia.
Oh, yes, the Peckinpah picture.
Yeah. He was like a good luck player,
mm-hmm.
a good luck player for certain directors.
Uh-huh.
Did a hell of a good Dillinger.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he did. Another Oklahoma shot film.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and he mm-hmm. played the utterly foredoomed and snake-bit Muff Potter in the 1973 version of Tom Sawyer.
Right. That's right. That's great. Right. I'd forgotten about that. Yeah, yeah.
But Warren Oates' ability to capture this kind of, I think, at least subliminally dangerous and yet pitiable character?
Yes.
Wow, you know, I got to watch this thing again.
Yeah, yeah. And it's amazing because, as you say, there's no character to pull for in the picture. There's nobody that's
there isn't worthwhile. Even a forbidden sympathy like you get with some of the better, Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Sure, sure, exactly.
It's by design and by result. I think it's quite a repulsive picture,
mm-hmm.
and it's brilliant.
It is brilliant. It is brilliant. It's very well done. Let's talk a little bit about the camera work. And I know that Ted McCord, I think Joey has a copy of the film that has an interview with Alexander Singer, who was doing the still photography and working in production on some other parts of the production of the picture.
Right.
And he talks about McCord, who was, this is, not intimates, he actually says he was trying to rebuild his career after he'd been hospitalized for alcoholism, and Ted McCord had done Tracer Sierra Madre. He'd done a ton of big pictures, or many big pictures, and he was brought on as by the actual director of photography in the film as a cameraman.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that scene, I mean, the most, and I don't think it's really self-conscious, but the scene that really stands out is when the shot is through the glass at the dancing couple I think Bolero is playing at that time, if I'm not mistaken.
I believe that's right.
And that's just, it's not self-consciously arty. It just seems to work for that situation.
It's a natural progression, consistent with his work, McCord's work in the big leagues.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, he had actually fallen into difficult times, Well, I mean, you go from the Burning Hills and I Died a Thousand Times, East of Eden,
mm-hmm.
and then what, only four, 5 or 6 years later, you're working on The Proud Rebel, that Disney imitation Disney picture that ended up getting released by Disney.
Oh, no, I don't know about that. What was that? Tell me about that.
Proud Rebel is an Alan Ladd production that was made on a shoestring by Sam Goldwyn Jr.
What year are we looking at?
1958. Mm-hmm. It came together very cheaply, very effectively. Alan and David Ladd, our old friend David Ladd,
from
Raw Meat or mm-hmm. Deathline, as it were. It's a post-Civil War thing. It involves a kid and his dog. And Disney was so impressed with it, they bought it and released it in the assumption that people might think it was a sequel to Old Yeller. That's how good it came out.
I see. Okay.
And, of course, McCord's photography, as on, The Hanging Tree,
mm-hmm.
The 1960 Huck Finn, what have you like that. Very artistic director whose downturn of fortunes in that period didn't affect his artistry in the slightest that I've ever noticed.
Well, apparently after this picture, he went on the upswing a little bit, if I'm reading things correctly, and kind of got back into the swim of things.
Yeah, he had reinstated himself in the major leagues with Warner Brothers Western series on television.
I see.
Cheyenne, for example.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay.
And ended up shooting, I think, my favorite Sean Connery movie, A Fine Madness, for example.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And of course, director of photography on The Sound of Music.
Well, you know, there's some great talent at work here. And you almost wonder if it had been toned down just a bit in terms mm-hmm. of the innuendo, in terms of just the sort of the blatant voyeurism and just the pervasive darkness, psychosexual darkness in the picture, that it might have actually found some sort of a run, because to me it's sort of as a precursor to Psycho in a lot of ways.
It feels a lot like Psycho. It was slower in gestation than Psycho. There were a lot of pictures in that vein at the time, and Hitchcock was coming off the influence of his own television show and what he could get away with
when
he made Psycho.
Mm-hmm.
A whole lot of network television series were getting really dark around that time. The network anthology series Thriller, for example.
Oh, yes.
About half supernatural horror and half film noir.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And speaking of which, you mentioned Bolero. The modern-day Hollywood composer most directly influenced by that composition was Pete Rugolo.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Who, of course, did the very third world beat sounding score for Thriller.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, of course, does the music on Private Property.
Right, right. And was kind of hooked up with that whole cool jazz thing, too, wasn't he?
Oh, not too many people took that influence into the big leagues. I think Henry Mancini, for the most part.
Yes, yes.
But,
right.
But Rugolo
and Mancini worked together, right? I mean, they did some stuff
together. They worked together, yeah. Mm-hmm. And you can hear the Rugolo influence on Mancini's score for the Blake Edwards picture Experiment in Terror.
Yes, absolutely you can.
But, Rugolo was the first composer, conductor I've ever heard who could make a flute sound scary.
Well, and so is this him performing Bolero on the soundtrack of Private Property?
I'd have to go back and look to see if that's canned or produced on the spot.
Because it's definitely, I mean, Bolero is, when you think of the picture and you think of the music, I mean, Bolero instantly comes to mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's because, I mean, did they use Bolero? I mean, it's allegedly one of the most sensuous pieces ever written, but did they also use that because it was also public domain and because Ravel you know, wasn't around to collect royalties.
Well, a small production company like that's going to cut the corners wherever it can.
And sometimes they'll do needle drop, and that's what I was wondering. Did they do you know, canned music, and that's what we're talking about, we just talked about.
That, you know. I don't know, but the original cues and what might be canned are very consistent with one another.
Well, now this is gone for was disappeared for a long time, and it's just been brought back out not all that long ago. And you can find it now in a really nice copy. And Joey, who was it that put out the new version of Private Property? Have you is that what you got, Michael, or did you see it?
No, I've got a Telecine off a TV print. I understand that the new digital video edition.
Yeah, Cinelicious did it. Cinelicious Picks did it.
Well, then it's a good thing I didn't know that before I ordered my new copy.
Right.
Cinelicious, huh?
Cinelicious, okay. Indeed. And it's got a commentary, as I say, by Alexander Singer, who worked on the picture. Maybe about the only one of those guys that's still around, you know, I don't know. But it's definitely worthwhile, and it's really... You know, I wouldn't exactly call it a horror film, but I wouldn't exactly not call it a horror film either.
Oh, dear, no. Psychological aberrations are always as creepy, as far as I'm concerned, as anything supernatural or science fictional.
Well, you know, one of my favorites, and we did this film weeks ago, but The Night Walker is just right up, and Day of the Nightmare in its own way was the same thing, and I agree with you.
Definitely.
And these two guys are very creepy, but the situation that Kate Manx is in is pretty creepy as well, and it's just,
well, yeah, and that sort of pairing of misfit leading men.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A British film from the same general period, The Man in the Back Seat, sort of thing. The Leopold and Loeb case that Richard Fleischer explored in, which one was that?
Was it Compulsion?
Compulsion.
Yeah.
Compulsion. I started to say Obsession, and then, no, that's another British film. Compulsion, that sort of thing. Much more creepy in that particular pairing than the characters had been portrayed in Hitchcock's Rope.
So do you suppose that Leopold and Loeb had that kind of influence on the popular culture, on our cultural memory?
They still do. I mean, there's a popularly priced paperback edition of a true crime book about their murder plot that... Gosh, it seemed like every time when I was a kid, every time I'd go to the newsstand, that same book would be there. You know, it was selling.
right.
And, you know, it's here it is again, but it's got a new cover. So, you know, I mean, that's that kind of stuff never goes away.
That's true. And the Leopold and Loeb case happened when? Do you recall?
The 1920s.
Okay, so that was the 20s. So it was a couple of generations past then, or a generation and a half past when. But it's still that arc of the two, because that's got it. That's got the whole precursor thing. The odd relationship and the forbidden almost relationship between the two characters, and you, because of this relationship, you never really know what they're going to be capable of doing.
And exactly right, and you find that dynamic recurring even into the modern day. I just watched an American remake of a picture called Funny Games, fairly recent in release, that pivots on the same kind of... Neither character is strong enough to be a leading character, but you put them together in that volatile, kind of a love-hate thing between them.
Right. And you never
really
know what's going to explode into something
exactly.
else.
Yeah, exactly. And it's really not that they're partners. It's that they are antagonists who can't let each other alone.
Would that be in psycho speak? Would they be codependent?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's basically good. What we're talking about, right? We're a couple of codependent people.
The enabler and the person who enables the enabler to enable.
That's right. That's exactly. Well, I think speaking for you, I can say that we both recommend this picture. It's a really unusual and I think very smart and very metaphorical picture in some ways. I think it's beyond, It goes like so many things. And we've talked before, I think we talked maybe last time we did this about the weird relationship between exploitation and art. Because art sometimes contains elements that people would see as exploitative. You look past those elements, and you can see art sometimes, and I think you can do that in private property.
That's how art gets made.
Yes.
I mean, you gotta have a hook to put it across. It's too bad that the picture didn't sell well enough to become a hit, but then if it had been enough of a hit to be widely popular, it probably wouldn't have been as good or effective as it is.
No. Maybe it'll be a hit in its way now that it's back out again.
Oh yeah, I hope so. You know, I mean, this is the picture. I when I was watching it for the first time not long ago, I thought this is the kind of picture Roman Polanski wishes he could make.
Right. Good point.
But you know, yeah, recommend the film. Certainly recommend while folks are at it, just get out there and splurge on the whole Outer Limits collection.
Yes.
The original series. And, for that matter, go out and check out everything you can find by Leslie Stevens, except maybe for the Return to the Blue Lagoon, and you'll be all right.
Yeah. Well, and I have to say, for those who are pinching pennies, don't mind watching ads that are aimed at the indigent and the old, you could get them on Comet TV. You know, the over-the-air TV network is showing shows two or three of the original Outer Limits every week. In addition to the new ones, they show the new ones and the old ones, both the Leslie Stevens ones, plus the updates.
Nice.
And I've watched them on that. And if you can, I think I told you that I don't have cable. I watch a lot of over-the-air television. We've never had cable at my house or Netflix or anything like that or satellite. So when this HD TV came along and all of these movie channels, It was a flashback for me because you were suddenly watching movies again that were cut up every 15 minutes by commercials, just as we'd watched films when we were kids. The difference being the target audience of the commercials. I'll never forget when I got up when one of them took a break. I think it was on Comet TV when a film took a break and the ad came on, and I was walking into the kitchen when I was stopped by the announcer's line, "People who use urinary catheters are smiling."
Oh, wow.
And I thought, I guess this is just the price you pay, because at my age, I suppose maybe they know their target audience. But anyway, they do show regularly the original Outer Limits on Comet TV, on the Comet TV
network.
Oh,
yeah, that's take it where you find it and enjoy it while you can get it. I went for years without seeing an Outer Limits episode in reruns or anything, and then I caught up with the collected works, and for a period there it was like, I think the trendy term would be binge watching.
Yes. Well, speaking of binge watching, if people want to binge read some Michael H. Price stuff, what do you got on the market new these days?
Oh, man. Well, the new edition of the Mantan-Moreland biography is
good.
Right,
it's a
there.
Wonderful book. I love that book, and I'll pick up that new one.
We have had tremendously good returns on that. Actually, the Forgotten Horrors books, from start to near finish, are performing like nobody's business. The big seller right now among those is Volume 10.
Yes. I've also noticed that ours, the one that we did, Nth Degree, has had a little bit of steam over the holidays.
Forgotten Horrors to the Nth Degree, yes. I've got to get some some tabulations on that here in the next week or so.
Right.
See how it's performing at market, as they say.
Right.
Because we really haven't been doing much in the way of advertising.
No, this is kind of, I mean, what people are hearing now, what you folks that are listening are hearing now, is just about the advertising we've been doing.
Yeah, that and Facebook.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. But and we also want to say to anyone who's bought any of our books and supported us over this past however long. I started to say the past year, but since a lot of people tune into this maybe later on, but we're doing this at the first part of 2017. And so anybody over the past year that looked up one of our books or got a book of ours, and we just really appreciate that very much. We appreciate the support a lot. And if you like this, you'll like those books, I think.
It's what we it's what keeps us in business. Most grateful for it, that.
We are indeed. And you know, all you have to do is go to Amazon and look up Michael H. Price or John Woolley, and you'll see pretty much what we're doing. You can see that we're jack of all trades and I'm master of none. I won't say that about Michael, but
yeah.
We've got a variety of stuff for everybody, from the baseball fan to the fan of horror comics, I guess.
There you go.
And everything in between. So thank you very much. We look forward to doing this again for another year. And, Michael, it's fun, and we'll be back at you before you know it.
Always a treat.
You bet.